part of the end of his journey, that there's truly a great deal more to learn, and we will have to we'll invite you back in about 10 years. There are microphones in the along the aisles, and I'll invite anyone who has a question to step to the microphone and speak.
At the very beginning of your lecture, you showed a slide which had Labna and one other site. We had the good fortune to see these, and I forget what the second one was.
It was Sahil,
however it's pronounced. But I do remember from our visits to both of those, the architecture is so startlingly different from what you would normally associate with Mayan civilization and what you see at Chichen Itza and the rest. Do you have any? Was this a different tradition, or has it been divided up like that? You mentioned the variability, how startlingly different some of the sites were. That certainly impressed us.
This was an area that had certainly been occupied, you know, prior to 800 AD, when you see this great fluorescence of these Kuk region sites. But you really have a major flourishing in that kind of century and a half, from about 750 to 900 AD. Architecturally, in many ways, it's different. There are similarities to sites further south in the Rio Bec region, Shkuhil and Chikana and others. So you can see where some of the tradition is coming from, but it is definitely a very different and unique flowering in that area. You see some of the Kuk style architecture also at Chichen Itza as well.
I'm just curious, do you think that part of the reason why Chuk couldn't let go of this, you know, peace-loving, you know, small community-type society, that the archaeologists became very paternalistic about these people, that it was their, you know, we were rescuing them from their oblivion, and, you know, they're our children, and we can't let go of this of being nice?
Obviously, I'm not a psychoanalyst of the archaeologist of the time, but I think that's a reasonable question. I think, in fact, if we look at the writings, as mentioned, especially of really gifted writers like Morley and Thompson, that they did identify with both the Maya of the modern period in Yucatan and Guatemala, with whom they worked and they had great affection for, and then by projection, you know, the Maya in the past. I think this was certainly in keeping with the nature of the archaeology at the time. Certainly one can argue that there are paternalistic overtones to that. I think archaeology today, understandably, is trying to engage the modern Maya you know, throughout Maya world. There are more than 6 million Maya-speaking peoples in Mexico and Guatemala and into Central America. Archaeologists now working in close cooperation, you know, from anything from ecotourism to cultural heritage preservation and revival. But I think these kinds of interests were there, but in certainly more modified form. But I think that identification with the Maya, and also projection, that this was a better life than we're seeing in the world today, certainly part.
Sort of to piggyback on that, I know that you talked about one of the tenets was that they were peace-loving people, but I feel like when I was learning about the Mayans, we always seemed to focus on the human sacrifices and things like that. I was just in Chichen Itza 2 weeks ago, and my tour guide was very much into the human sacrifices and telling us all about it. What is the current, you know, scholarship on that?
Well, I think, as best one can say, there clearly was human sacrifice, but it was... There's no evidence that it was at the scale, certainly that we know from Spanish ethnohistory among the Aztecs in central Mexico. So I think clearly at major ceremonial events there would have been sacrifice. We find that kind of evidence in dedications to buildings and at major events. But at least from all intents we see in the archaeology, this was not frequent. Whether it happened, you know, once a month, once a year, and so on, I think it's harder to tell. But it's on that scale, no, it does not seem to be happening once. And in fact, from what little we know from were sacrificed or actually either captives from other communities or in fact people who were bought in later times. There was evidence, at least in late post-classic, that you might well have had slavery and that these were some of the victims. So the answer is yes, but not, I think, probably as the tour guide would have you believe.
Thank you.
We'll have time for two more questions.
Is there any connection between the Egyptian monuments and the Mayan monuments?
None that I, or I think almost any of my colleagues, are aware of. First of all, there's a huge difference in time. If you look at the temples, of one picture of Giza I showed, you're looking, going back 2800 BC, the major Maya ones don't start till about 300 BC, so you're looking at well more than 2,000 years difference in time. But I think more importantly, you can actually see the development through time in the Maya era. There's no indication that these are the ideas from monument building, pyramid building, or anything the like are wrapped certainly brought in from the outside, and in kind of physical artifactual evidence, there are absolutely no links to Egypt that we're aware of. So Thor Heyerdahl going with a rod was a wonderful feat of adventure, but I think does not link to any archaeological reality.
Are there any linguistic links?
Not that I'm aware of.
Thank you. Would you please comment on Banan Pat's mural and also on any connection between the Olmec civilizations and the Mayan civilizations as developed in the Science Times this year?
I have a picture also I'd like you to comment on.
Thank you.
The Bonaparte murals, which in fact were found by a group related to the Carnegie Institution of Washington in the 1940s, Doug Healy, and published by the Carnegie, show wonderful examples of late classic Maya art. We now have, in the 40s and 50s, it was unique. There are now a number of other examples of these kinds of murals. In this case, probably showing the results of a raid where Bonaparte successfully raided a nearby site, captured its ruler, and that ruler is actually beheaded. And you can see the head on the steps and the captive figures. The captives are always shown either naked or nearly naked and with the ornately garb of victor. So it's a nice example, probably one of the first ones to show that the peaceful view of the Maya really didn't hold. Now, connections between the Maya and Olmec, this is an area of a lot of interesting research now. Clearly, there were a host of links, say around 1000 BC, from the Gulf Coast lowlands, modern-day Veracruz and Tabasco, which is the heartland of the Olmec, into Oaxaca in the southern Mexican highlands, into Chiapas, highlands of Guatemala, and the Maya lowlands, that indicate that all were in close contact at this time. Great debate. Is this Olmec influencing some of the other groups? Is it Oaxaca influencing the Olmec and so on? I think this is an open question now, but clearly there were good close contacts with peoples throughout Mesoamerica at that important time when we see the beginnings of monumentality and the rise of all these labor-intensive projects, high arts, and so on. And it's probably in the ferment of interaction that leads to all the different developments in the Olmec, the Maya, Oaxaca, the highlands.
This has been a fascinating evening, not only for its exposure of the Mayan, changing views of the Mayans, but also for exposure, at least to me, of some of the history of the Carnegie Institute. Some history that actually we glossed and it's useful to have it revealed. Please join me in thanking Professor Sadler.